Section D. Applying these principles, we conclude that the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction to hear petitioner's appeal. The district court's order denying petitioner's motion to dismiss turned on an issue of law and rejected the defense of qualified immunity. It was therefore a final decision subject to immediate appeal. Respondent says that a qualified immunity appeal based solely on the complaint's failure to state a claim and not on the ultimate issues relevant to the qualified immunity defense itself is not a proper subject of interlocutory jurisdiction. In other words, respondent contends the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction to determine whether his complaint avers a clearly established constitutional violation, but that it lacked jurisdiction to pass on the sufficiency of his pleadings. Our opinions, however, make clear that appellate jurisdiction is not so strictly confined. In Hartman v. Moore in 2006, the court reviewed an interlocutory decision denying qualified immunity. The legal issue decided in Hartman concerned the elements a plaintiff must plead and prove in order to win a First Amendment retaliation claim. Similarly, two terms ago in Wilkie v. Robbins, 2007, the court considered another interlocutory order denying qualified immunity. The legal issue there was whether a Bivens action can be employed to challenge interference with property rights. These cases cannot be squared with the respondent's argument that the collateral order doctrine restricts appellate jurisdiction to the ultimate issue, whether the legal wrong asserted was a violation of clearly established law, while excluding the question whether the facts pleaded establish such a violation. Indeed, the latter question is even more clearly within the category of appealable decisions than the questions presented in Hartman and Wilkie, since whether a particular complaint sufficiently alleges a clearly established violation of law cannot be decided in isolation from the facts pleaded. In that sense, the sufficiency of respondents' pleadings is both inextricably intertwined with and directly implicated by the qualified immunity defense. Respondent counters that our holding in Johnson confirms the want of subject matter jurisdiction here. That is incorrect. The allegation in Johnson was that five defendants, all of them police officers, unlawfully beat the plaintiff. Johnson considered the appealability of a portion of the district court summary judgment order that, though entered in a qualified immunity case, determined only that there was a genuine issue of material fact that three of the defendants participated in the beating. In finding that order not a final decision for purposes of Section 1291, the Johnson court cited Mitchell for the proposition that only decisions turning on an issue of law are subject to immediate appeal. Though determining whether there is a genuine issue of material fact that summary judgment is a question of law, it is a legal question that sits near the law-fact divide, or as we said in Johnson, it is a fact-related legal inquiry. To conduct it, a court of appeals may be required to consult a vast pretrial record with numerous conflicting affidavits, depositions, and other discovery materials. That process generally involves matters more within a district court's ken and may replicate inefficiently questions that will arise on appeal following final judgment. Finding those concerns predominant, Johnson held that the collateral orders that are final under Mitchell turn on abstract rather than fact-based issues of law. The concerns that animated the decision in Johnson are absent when an appellate court considers the disposition of a motion to dismiss a complaint with insufficient pleadings. True, the categories of fact-based and abstract legal questions used to guide the court's decision in Johnson are not well defined. Here, however, the order denying petitioner's motion to dismiss falls well within the latter class. Reviewing that order, the Court of Appeals considered only the allegations contained within the four corners of respondent's complaint. Resort to a vast pretrial record on petitioner's motion to dismiss was unnecessary. And determining whether respondent's complaint has the heft to state a claim is a task well within an appellate court's core competency. Evaluating the sufficiency of a complaint is not a fact-based question of law, so the problem the court sought to avoid in Johnson is not implicated here. The district court's order denying petitioner's motion to dismiss is a final decision under the collateral order doctrine, over which the Court of Appeals had, and this court has, jurisdiction. We proceed to consider the merits of petitioner's appeal. Part 3. In Twombly, the court found it necessary first to discuss the antitrust principles implicated by the complaint. Here, too, we begin by taking note of the elements a plaintiff must plead to state a claim of unconstitutional discrimination against officials entitled to assert the defense of qualified immunity. In Bivens, proceeding on the theory that a right suggests a remedy, this court recognized for the first time an implied private action for damages against federal officers alleged to have violated a citizen's constitutional rights. Because implied causes of action are disfavored, the court has been reluctant to extend Bivens' liability to any new context or new category of defendants. That reluctance might well have disposed of respondents' First Amendment claim of religious discrimination, for while we have allowed a Bivens action to redress a violation of the equal protection component of the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, we have not found an implied damages remedy under the Free Exercise Clause. Indeed, we have declined to extend Bivens to a claim sounding in the First Amendment. Petitioners do not press this argument, however, so we assume without deciding that respondents' First Amendment claim is actionable under Bivens. In the limited settings where Bivens does apply, the implied cause of action is the federal analog to suits brought against state officials under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. Based on the rules our precedents establish, respondent correctly concedes that government officials may not be held liable for the unconstitutional conduct of subordinates under a theory of respondeat superior. Because vicarious liability is inapplicable to Bivens and Section 1983 suits, a plaintiff must plead that each government official defendant, through the official's own individual actions, has violated the Constitution. The factors necessary to establish a Bivens violation will vary with the constitutional provision at issue. Where the claim is invidious discrimination in contravention of the First and Fifth Amendments, our decisions make clear that the plaintiff must plead and prove that the defendant acted with discriminatory purpose. Under extant precedent, purposeful discrimination requires more than intent as volition or intent as awareness of consequences. It instead involves a decision maker's undertaking a course of action because of, and not merely in spite of, the action's adverse effect upon an identifiable group. It follows that to state a claim based on a violation of a clearly established right, respondent must plead sufficient factual matter to show that petitioners adopted and implemented the detention policies at issue not for a neutral investigative reason, but for the purpose of discriminating on account of race, religion, or national origin. Respondent disagrees. He argues that under a theory of supervisory liability, petitioners can be liable for knowledge and acquiescence in their subordinates' use of discriminatory criteria to make classification decisions among detainees. That is to say, respondent believes the supervisor's mere knowledge of his subordinates' discriminatory purpose amounts to the supervisor's violating the Constitution. We reject this argument. Respondent's conception of supervisory liability is inconsistent with his accurate stipulation that petitioners may not be held accountable for the misdeeds of their agents. In a Section 1983 suit or a Bivens action, where masters do not answer for the torts of their servants, the term supervisory liability is a misnomer. Absent vicarious liability, each government official, his or her title notwithstanding, is only liable for his or her own misconduct. In the context of determining whether there is a violation of clearly established right to overcome qualified immunity, purpose rather than knowledge is required to impose Bivens liability on the subordinate for unconstitutional discrimination. The same holds true for an official charged with violations arising from his or her superintendent responsibilities. Part 4, Section A. We turn to respondent's complaint. Under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 8A2, a pleading must contain a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief. As the court held in Twombly, a pleading standard Rule 8 announces does not require detailed factual allegations, but it demands more than an unadorned, "the defendant unlawfully harmed me," accusation. A pleading that offers labels and conclusions or a formulaic recitation of the elements of a cause of action will not do, nor does a complaint suffice if it tenders naked assertions devoid of further factual enhancement. To survive a motion to dismiss, a complaint must contain sufficient factual matter accepted as true to state a claim to relief that is plausible on its face. A claim has facial plausibility when the plaintiff pleads factual content that allows the court to draw the reasonable inference that the defendant is liable for the misconduct alleged. The plausibility standard is not akin to a probability requirement, but it asks for more than a sheer possibility that a defendant has acted unlawfully. Where a complaint pleads facts that are merely consistent with a defendant's liability, it stops short of the line between possibility and plausibility of entitlement to relief. Two working principles underlie our decision in Twombly. First, the tenet that a court must accept as true all of the allegations contained in a complaint is inapplicable to legal conclusions. Threadbare recitals of the elements of the cause of action supported by mere conclusory statements do not suffice. Although for the purposes of a motion to dismiss, we must take as true all of the factual allegations, we are not bound to accept as true the legal conclusion couched as a factual allegation. Rule 8 marks a notable and generous departure from the hyper-technical code pleading regime of a prior era, but it does not unlock the doors of discovery for a plaintiff armed with nothing more than conclusions. Second, only a complaint that states a plausible claim for relief survives a motion to dismiss. Determining whether a complaint states a plausible claim for relief will, as the Court of Appeals observed, be a context-specific task that requires the reviewing court to draw on its judicial experience and common sense. But where the well-pleaded facts do not permit the court to infer more than the mere possibility of misconduct, the complaint has alleged, but it has not shown, that the pleader is entitled to relief. In keeping with these principles, a court considering a motion to dismiss can choose to begin by identifying pleadings that, because they are no more than mere conclusions, are not entitled to the assumption of truth. While legal conclusions can provide the framework of a complaint, they must be supported by factual allegations. When there are well-pleaded factual allegations, a court should assume their veracity and then determine whether they plausibly give rise to an entitlement to relief. Our decision in Twombly illustrates the two-pronged approach. There, we considered the sufficiency of a complaint alleging that incumbent telecommunications providers had entered an agreement not to compete and to forestall competitive entry in violation of the Sherman Act, 15 U.S.C. Section 1. Recognizing that Section 1 enjoins only anti-competitive conduct effected by a contract, combination, or conspiracy, the plaintiffs in Twombly flatly pleaded that the defendant had entered into a contract, combination, or conspiracy to prevent competitive entry and had agreed not to compete with one another. The complaint also alleged that the defendant's parallel course of conduct to prevent competition and inflate prices was indicative of the unlawful agreement alleged. The court held that the plaintiff's complaint deficient under Rule 8. In doing so, it first noted that the plaintiff's assertion that such an unlawful agreement was a legal conclusion and as such was not entitled to the assumption of truth. Had the court simply credited the allegation of a conspiracy, the plaintiffs would have stated a claim for relief and have been entitled to proceed for force. The court next addressed the nub of the plaintiff's complaint, the well-pleaded, non-conclusory, factual allegation of parallel behavior, to determine whether it gave rise to a plausible suggestion of conspiracy. Acknowledging that parallel conduct was consistent with an unlawful agreement, the court nevertheless concluded that it did not plausibly suggest an illicit accord because it was not only compatible with, but indeed was more likely explained by, lawful, unchoreographed, free market behavior. Because the well-pleaded fact of parallel conduct accepted as true did not plausibly suggest an unlawful agreement, the court held the plaintiff's complaint must be dismissed.